This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
Great. It's wonderful to see all of you. Thank you. Great showing, and welcome to everyone here. Nice to be with all of you again. So let's get started, and I'd like to introduce Tanya Bonner, who is a social policy and media consultant based out of New York City and Chicago and Illinois. She helps grassroots and nonprofit organizations and faith-based organizations gain recognition and support for their social justice initiatives, including making sure those initiatives demonstrate cultural competence. She's a policy creator and dismantler, a creative, a social justice advocate, writer, MBA, filmmaker, and former daily newspaper reporter. She has written blog posts on major social justice issues and has written and reported on law enforcement issues for over 10 years as a reporter at several major daily newspapers around the country. She also brags that she and former First Lady Michelle Obama graduated from the same high school in Chicago. She will be our trusty, reverent facilitator for this panel. Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Helena.
It's yours. Who's first up?
All right. I should also mention I've been a Sangha member here at Fire Lotus since about 2006, off and on. First, I want to introduce Jordan, who's going to go over how we're going to introduce ourselves and kind of explain why we introduce ourselves in that way.
Hi, my name is Jordan. My pronouns are she and her. For some people, maybe this is new, maybe for others not so much, but everyone's going to say their names and also their pronouns. Pronouns for me in my life and kind of the world that I move through, we're always talking about our pronouns. Pronouns aren't just about trans people. I feel like there's this misconception about that. All of us have gender identities, and the idea of the binary isn't quite how it works in our lives. It's not how we experience our genders. So you can't assume anybody's gender or their pronouns just by seeing them, much like I couldn't guess any one of your names just by walking up to you on the street. So we want to make this a part of our culture in a way that, you know, resembles how we all exist in the world. So everybody will say their pronouns, and it can also be difficult, I think, for some people to get used to using people's pronouns, particularly if they have gender-neutral pronouns or how you look at them may not feel the way you think their pronouns should be. And in this context, it feels similar to Dharma names. Those syllables and those words don't really mean anything to us in a broader cultural sense because they come from country far away from us that we don't have direct contact with, but we all accept them. We learn them, we figure them out, we stumble a little bit, but we respect them. So that's something we'll do today throughout the panel and want to move forward doing that in the future in our Sangha. And if that wasn't clear, we can talk about it later.
Thank you, Jordan. As many of you know, we did this same forum at the Zen Mountain Monastery last Sunday. So apologies in advance to the panel that have to hear my corny jokes twice. Some will be repeats. So I do apologize. So I'm going to start actually with Shoan. When I first got here, I have to say I was one of the first people I met. Like, she walked up to me and was like, "Hi, who are you? How are you doing?" And all I remember, I didn't even know her name. I was like, well, you know, because I was being ignored most of the time when I was here, and I sort of felt kind of like invisible. And I was like, well, and I remember asking like Joshin and Jordan, like, "Who is that white woman with the deer eyes, the big doe deer eyes? Like, she's really nice. Like, who is she?" And they were like, "Oh, that's Sean." I was like, "Oh, wow." So anyway, thank you so much for being so welcoming to me when I first got here. And I want to start with you to kind of tell everybody, explain what we mean by Beyond Fear of Differences, a.k.a. BFOD. What is that? And tell us a little bit about the mission and goal of BFOD and what our process is, what our work, what we do as part of this process.
Okay. So my name is Shawn, and my pronouns are she, her. And the Beyond Fear of Differences initiative, you know, it's real people in our sangha, in our community, looking at issues of equity and diversity and power within the sangha. And in a sense, it's been, it's kind of most brought to life, I think, what this group has been to now, at least this facet of it, this working body of people, by our timeline. So I hope you get a chance to look at that, because that tells the story of the group so far. And if you don't get a chance to look at it today, it is on the website in PDF format, so you can take more time with it later. We're in a community. It's a community in a particular context. I think Hogan Sensei very eloquently sort of framed the context that we find ourselves in when we use a term like white supremacy. And so inevitably, our community is reflecting our social context. And so how do we overturn that, disrupt that, infuse it with genuine equity and genuinely shared power for our Dharma practice, for our collective liberation? Zuiko answered this question about what is BFOD last week on Sunday really so beautifully. She said, you know, it's looking at these issues as Dharma practice, not through the lens of Dharma practice, not as being integrated into Dharma practice, but as none other than Dharma practice. So when we're looking at the study of the self, when we're looking at what is suffering and the cessation of suffering, we see all of these issues as one and the same. I also want to mention, because I'm sensitive to it and it was brought to my attention earlier, you know, right now our working group has really focused a lot on race, and that came to be the necessary focus of our work. But the initiative moving forward already has an LGBTQ group that is functioning and hopefully will blossom and grow. There's the What is Whiteness group that is already in place and thriving here at the temple. And so these things are also part of this initiative and hopefully will be coming into closer contact and closer relationships. So it's really one movement that our sangha is taking up together.
Thank you so much, Sean, for that great explanation. And again, we're going to double back to this in the end, at the end, and we'll be able to answer a few more of your questions about what we do and the ways this is set up and ways you can get involved. So look forward to that. Also, before we actually get too deep into the panel discussion, I wanted to also mention that what we're going to be doing is, as you're listening to, as you're listening to the panel, we're going to have some note cards at the beginning of each row, and you can write down your questions. And we'll also give you some time after the panel to think about if you had questions that resulted from hearing this panel. And then what you'll do is write those questions down. We'll collect them, and then we'll choose a few to answer. The reason we do it this way is obviously because of time, and it's just the most efficient way. But all of your questions will be answered. If you gave us a question, we will answer those questions in another form later after this forum. So be aware of that. And then our last exercise, one of our other exercises, we'll be doing prompts, and those things are in a hallway. And we'll explain more of that as we get to that. But it's a really important part of this process. And it also was overwhelmingly helpful to us at Zen Mountain Monastery. They really responded and put things on the NLAT prompt wall. It's been so helpful. So I encourage you to really do that process. It allows you to anonymously express how you're feeling about everything you're taking in today. So thank you. Okay, so we're going to get right into it. Thank you so much, Hogan, for that. Hogan. Now, on the timeline, you probably saw in July of 2017, I wrote a proposal because basically it has gotten to the point where myself and others were involved, including Marie and other people, in terms of just how things were going, which was we didn't feel they were going anywhere in terms of issues of diversity, inclusion, and all of these different issues. And so it just got to a point where I was tired. And I said, look, we want to put together this proposal and say and appeal directly to the monastics and say, this is how we want this to change. These are some of the ways that we feel they should change. And here are our suggestions. And it was a really scary time to do that because people were concerned about the response of how we're going to be received. And so the first person after I sent that I spoke to was actually Hogan on the phone, who called me to follow up. And Hogan, as the co-director of this Zen Center of New York City, a.k.a. Fire Lotus, again, like you were the first person I spoke to. Now, when we talked about, you know, being more open to ways of, you know, having more teachers of color come in and teach here, one of the things that stuck with me is you and I sort of had a conversation and you said, well, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but you said, you know, you were concerned about the Dharma and the purity of that. And, you know, we sort of had a little moment, you and I. A moment. And, you know, so explain a little bit more about how you were feeling in that moment talking to me. And then I can double back on that.
Yeah. If I had to sum it up in one word. No. Sorry. My name is Hogan. He and him. So if I had to sum it up, it would be the word no. So what underlies that, if I may?
Let's go ahead. Go for it.
I know what the Dharma is. You don't. This is the Dharma. That's not. I'm entrusted with this. You're not. I have an agenda. You have an agenda. Guess what? And I don't like your attitude.
Yeah, that's about how I received it, too. Now, would you like to... They're better than when we prep for this, right? You know, can you explain a little bit more about why you felt that way? Like, where were you in that moment? And have you evolved since?
Well, what do you think I'm going to say? I thought I expressed where I was at that moment. And my previous comments. But let me just pause a moment and feel if there's more I can say. Well, also, I felt I didn't know you. And so I didn't trust, you know, I was feeling what I received as anger and directness that you did not have my permission to put forth. And trust is important for me, and so I didn't particularly trust what you were saying. So there was that. You want to ask anything else? There's another part to your question.
Go for it.
It's hard for me to describe how the process went forward from there, but it was a bit startling to me, not immediately, but afterwards, when I thought about my responses, because they were very rooted in fear and protection. And so which underlies everything I said. And, you know, when I put it in those terms, that's a flashing. It's more than a flashing. It's a bright red light for me that here are my vows. Here's this emotional charge. But that wasn't enough. That isn't enough. That's just pay attention to this point and see if you could have responded more skillfully. That's where that takes me. See if I could, meaning I could have responded more skillfully, which doesn't address the questions you were asking at all. And so, in talking with Shugan about this, he basically said, go get educated. And I said, okay, I will. It's my teacher. He's telling me what I need. He I trusted. You had told me what I needed. You I didn't trust. And so Eho and I went to a 3-day workshop. It's a very powerful experience to me. Still to this day, it's very, very powerful. A lot of what I said today in the opening remarks came from that and impressed me. And impressed me because I was receiving the personal suffering of people of color and how they receive it within this society's. And also impressed upon me that I could not have that experience. I was not going to have their experience.
Yeah, you know, thank you for being honest and authentic. That's one of our number 10 on our list of values. Because I can say I it really cut me deep. I'm going to say that. I mean, because I, you know, someone looking at me and saying, well, I don't trust you or where you're from. That's a daily experience. And even though I had been here, I'd been at this Sangha, I had been coming, you know, to feel as if you, to have someone put up those blocks. And I felt also it was beyond me. It wasn't just my experience. It was the experience of all the people of color, some of whom you knew very intimately. One was on the board. We're talking about all of us and our experience. And when you cast aside my experience, my voice, you were casting them aside as well. Because, and so in that sense, you know, it really hurt. And I also was very confused because we didn't come to this conclusion that we needed to make these changes just individually. It was something that all of us felt was very important. And that was one of the reasons why there was a lot of trepidation, I have to say, about even putting out this document. Because, you know, we were fighting, like literally, like the day it was sent, she was like, I don't feel good about this. And I said, I'm hitting send at 2:00. At 2:00, you got till 2:00. And if you don't get back to me and tell me, I'm hitting send. And then she was like, well, do what you got to do. And I hit send. And this was the reason, because we all felt like our experience is going to be questioned, or it was going to be cast aside, or it was going to be met with doubt, or, you know, or who are you to tell us how to do, make some changes. But also deeper than that, before we move on, when you think about all the teachers out here who are teachers of color in Buddhism and all the things they have to offer, what does that say about us when we say, Buddha was a person of color? So we're going to say, wait, we can't, I don't trust the Buddha. Like, I don't trust this person, you know? So what are we saying about people who don't look like the majority of people in this Sangha when we say that I don't trust where that's coming from? And what is that going to look like? You know, witchcraft or something, you know? But it's the people call, you know, we have so many people out there who do this every day. They teach and they're doing this, but they're not welcomed into these spaces. And so it really cut deep. And so that's why I think that moment was really important. And I still remember it to this. I mean, it was 2 years ago, and I still remember that conversation.
Well, the power of that conversation was like a delayed time bomb. It just kept burrowing into me. I actually don't think until I just heard you speak that I realized how much the depth of the pain that I had caused. Thank you. And so that hurts, you know, and my response to my pain is, that's what you need to see. That's what I need. When I see you, I mean me. Yeah. I'm talking, you know.
Do you trust me a little bit more now? Or
I actually are we trust getting you there? Completely.
Oh, okay.
It's my only hope.
Thank you so much. Now I want to move on to Marie and hear a little bit from Marie and Joshin. They've both been at the Sangha for a long time. Many of you probably know them. And I wanted to ask you all, because as the timeline shows, you know, change here has been very slow. As you see, it goes all the way back to 2009. And we're just here today doing this particular thing. So I want to ask you all from your experience, you know, as women of color, Sangha members, did you feel this snail-like progression? And, you know, tell us a little bit more about how that impacted you both personally and spiritually, your spiritual growth, having this snail-like progression in addressing these issues.
My name is Marie, pronoun she, her. Initially, when I started coming to the Sangha many years ago, I just used to come, sit, and live. You know, hi, hello, goodbye. And not until a few years ago, I was putting on my boots and I was sitting next to the door that Ganjo came up and said, "What's your name?" Incidentally, she was white. And someone else was going out and I said, "Marie." And she said, "Oh, this is Marie. She's a member of the Sangha." And I was like, "Wait, I don't want to be that. I just want to come sit and leave. Listen, take some notes and leave. I don't want to be part of this." But not until I started coming more frequently and getting more acquainted with Shohan also. He was very nice to me, you know, introduced himself and made me feel welcome. And we started doing this work that I feel that there was a need. I had no clue that people in the Sangha were so lost when it came to racism and race. And not, you know, with the POC, it made me understand that there was a need for people of color to get together and to talk about their experiences. Because when I looked around, I saw a handful of people of color, and we all nodded because, you know, that's what people of color do when you're in a room with
people. We're all up
people.
Here on the stage.
Yes. We acknowledge each other by a nod, saying, "Yes, I see you, I'm with you." But being in this work has opened me up so much to be accepting of the pain, mostly that we have gone through, that we are going through, and also of the pain of ignorance of the white Sangha members. So I'm here with you all, that this work will continue and we'll all grow together.
Joshin?
Sure. Thank you. When I look out at you all, I think, Joshin, she and her, I think my Sangha, because I've been with you for such a long time, and some of you just, you know, like me and Marie, we text each other, we'll see each other. Some it's just a matter of seeing you when I come, and I'm so heartened by that. And I love this temple. And when I went to the monastery, as you'll preface, but I went to the monastery to do this forum. Most people think that's the show. I said, that's the prep for the temple. I just want to see how it goes down there so we can do it right for the temple. And that is always my my first concern, because unabashedly, this is where the people of color come from, for the most part, to the MRO. It's the first entrance. I mean, Jordan didn't come through the temple. You were a Brooklyn resident, and you came straight to the monastery, and some people do that. But for the most part, the people of color who are at the monastery come through the temple. And I feel like if we grow it here, if we encourage it here, if we nurture it here, it will get to the monastery. It will get up there. It will get up there. But lo and behold, it's taken quite a long time. It does get there a little bit, but it needed the effort, a concerted effort that I think Tanya has really brought to us and spearheaded for us. because otherwise it was just a couple of us talking to each other and saying, when are things going to change? When are we going to see more people of color here? When are we going to get a person of color doing a Sunday talk? And then GeekCon became a senior, then he did. And I don't know if you've listened to GeekCon's talks, but they are awesome. So the journey for me spiritually has been that sometimes you don't know what's missing until you get it. And then it's been a revelation. It's changed my Dharma practice. It's changed my relationship to Shugen, to my teachers, to Hojin, to Hogan, to everybody, to be able to talk honestly about who I am, demand that that be part of what we do here, to see it coming and happening, but to be authentically yourself completely and feel like that's okay. That's like a whole new Dharma practice. And that also came across to me when we did the Healing the Wounds of Racism retreat, which some of us went to. It was a person of color only retreat that we've only had here for the first time, coming about through the work that we're doing here. And it was, again, a revelation, totally Dharma-based, things that we know. We know silence. We know mindfulness. It was all that, but then it was also with this container of your family matters, your language matters, your ancestry matters, and you can bring them into the Zendo with you. And again, such a small tweak, so Dharma-based and so powerful. So I am feeling like I'm hopeful that we continue, and I'm so overjoyed that we're bringing this to you, because you are my Sangha, and I totally believe that you will be with us on this, and that you know and feel it too.
Thank you so much, Joshin. That was beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, because I think we've all been there and experienced exactly how you laid it out. Now we're still talking about changes and what the changes that we've been going through. And keeping with that, there was an elephant in this room. I don't know if you saw the elephant, but it's actually on the timeline. It's at 2009. There's a, I don't know if you noticed, but everything's been happening since 2009. And I started thinking, what's the significance of 2009? What happened before 2009? Oh, you know, so it was a mystery to me. And then I thought about it and I said, Daido Roshi. Daido Roshi. That was the difference. And so I'm going to turn this over to Hojin and Sean and to address a little bit about that elephant in the room. And could B5 specifically have been possible in the Daido Roshi period? And why is it more possible now? Could this have happened?
Let me just say that I really care a lot about Daido Roshi, and I would not be here if it weren't for him. Having said that, I do not think that this work would be happening. I mean, you know, it's impossible to say because Daido was living his life and maybe he would have changed. But, you know, a lot of the things that we can easily point to as reasons that distinguish the practice and training here and at the monastery in positive ways, we owe to Daidoshi, okay? The liturgy, the emphasis on the rigor and depth of the practice and of the teachings, and a kind of uncompromising flavor, that is from Daido. At the same time, I think that he was afraid of challenges to his power and authority. He was kind of the consummate patriarch and didn't really see any problem with that. And was easily threatened, actually, by confrontations, by questioning, by suggestions that someone else wanted to do something different or new or was initiating change. So, I mean, Hoj, what would you add to that?
My teacher, like many of us, was a complex individual. I don't think we were ready in the sense, just because of his patriarchal stance in the first place, and what could even the system that represents a much larger system just in this one body that was holding us in place. So we had to first deal with that, which we couldn't really. It was kind of a impenetrable sort of placement. And it was tried to challenge, but most of those challengers are not even in the Sangha anymore. That's how hard it was. So I don't know about the timing of it in terms of who he was, where the culture was at the monastery, what the force was of him trying to establish and us trying to undo. I don't know that we were at a point to take it apart, because it was just, he had such a force of bringing it together, because it was only him. It didn't necessarily have to be that way, but that's how he works, you know, and he knew the Dharma, and, you know, and so it was hard to get there. So he's a product of his time, you know, as he got older, I don't know, perhaps he would have had no choice. He wouldn't have had the strength of what was arising, because it was. It was. And you see, the moment he dies, 2009, boom, first meeting. So it was just waiting there like an incubator. It was always on Shugan's mind. He grew up in the South, and it was always a part of his growing up. So it was a very... it was already in his consciousness. So it's not, it started right then. And I was thinking about there wasn't space for much difference. It was more fixing things, and this is not a fixing thing. This is making space for difference. We're not fixing difference. We're going to be different. We are different, and we are the same. So that's.
Thank you. What I have to say. Thank you so much, because it's important for us to look at our history, and look at the context in which this is taking place. And like you said, it's not to dishonor anyone. It's just to show that this is the evolution, and why that evolution took place, and why that evolution sometimes can meet challenges along the way. Speaking of evolution, we've been really talking a lot in BFOD about the evolution of the residency program. We have, as you know, residency here and also at Zen Mountain. And Jordan comes into the picture as a very... unique figure in that, for many reasons. When I first saw Jordan, I was like, who is that? Because she was like the only one. When I would go up to the monastery, and she would be like the only Black person there. And I'm like, wow. I wanted to say, how are you doing? You know, are you okay? You know? You know, but because most of the time it was silent, you know, we couldn't really ask those kind of questions. But Jordan is also, as you probably know, a law student right now at CUNY Law, doing very well, and we're very proud of her. Yeah. And I told my corny joke before, I'll tell it again, that she also is a model. Yeah. She models our Thai Fisher Person pants in our room. So you've probably seen Jordan with these wonderful poses, you know, and the brochure. She has used this, people. She has used. So Jordan, I want to talk to you about the residency program. And you are also, as people probably don't know, she's the first Black person to complete a year-long residency at Zen Mountain Monastery. Major accomplishment. I want you to talk about that experience. Because she wrote an account about her experience that brought me to tears. Like, it was so raw and so honest about what she had experienced. And I want you to talk a little bit about that. Talk about your experience and how BFOD is helping, that you hope this is going to transform that experience for residents in the future.
Yeah, so I graduated from undergrad in 2015, and in May, and in the end of June, the beginning of July, I started residency. Making that decision was really difficult. Telling my parents, I grew up in the Baptist church. You tell black people monastery, they're like, no way. It was just so many things coming at me. Like, what are you doing? Who are these people you're going to live with? They knew what everybody was going to look like. So it was a lot of fear for them. And for me, I was just like, I'm going to do this. I've been around white people. They're everywhere. It's just the world that I live in. I went to undergrad upstate New York in a small town on Oneonta, just white people everywhere. So it wasn't, I didn't think about it so much as an obstacle. But then you start sitting, you start practicing, and the walls begin to fall apart. And it was also a really auspicious time because Rashawn, who is a black man who didn't quite finish his year of residency, he was also there. We started the same month. We both wanted to stay a year. So in a lot of ways, the universe was sending the monastery something to work with, something it was not ready for. The monastery was not ready for our pain and our suffering. And I think about Rashawn a lot because I think he didn't finish his residency because nobody was ready to deal with his pain. Shugan could not deal with his pain. The monastics could not deal with his pain. And he just couldn't do it. And that really, really hurts my heart, because that means that there are hundreds of other black people and people of color who their pain might not be, there might not be space for their pain at the monastery. And this BFOD feels like the thing that opens that up. Bring space for the pain that particularly black Americans experience living in this country and in this world. When I started residency, I was going to do a year. Hojin, in a lot of ways, gave me the heart of the monastery. She said, you're going to be the registrar. You are going to take care of the Sangha. And I was not ready. I was incredibly afraid. But it put me in this really particular position where, like, I got to know everybody. Like, I know everybody. And
yes, you did.
I knew everybody. Everybody knew me. And I was in the middle of everything, but I was still alone. I was really alone and didn't have anywhere to take my pain to. I couldn't go to the teachers. I mean, I did, and it was messy, and it was bad. And they hurt me. And I yelled at them about it. And they listened, and I went back and told them again, you're still doing it. You're not listening to me, Shugan. You're letting me down. You're not doing what you're supposed to. And I kept doing that over and over and over again. And in a lot of ways, he took all of it. He didn't hear all of it. He didn't know what to do with a lot of it, but he was listening over and over and over again. The narrative that Tanya talked about, once we started to do the BFOD work, it was just me and this group of white people, and we're talking about race and power at the monastery. And they're like, we're doing really nice, We're all good, nice, white, liberal people. What could be wrong? I'm like, oh, my God, everything is wrong. And I got to a point where I was like, okay, I have to let these people know that, like, their perception of the Sangha is not actually how it is. The violence that is white supremacy, the violence that comes out of nice white people who think, everything's fine, but it's not. I really had to say, like, this is what you're doing to me. One of the things that I remember, Rashawn and I, we would hang out, and other residents would kind of see us, and they're like, what are you up to? You're up to something, aren't you? Why were we up to something? What were we doing? Just two black people hanging out at the monastery? But nobody thought it was violent, but that was violent. People assuming that Rashawn and I were a couple and that we had to be together, that two black people couldn't just happen to be there independently and on their own. You must be together. You have to be a unit. Why would you be here? In so many words, you don't really belong here. So in a lot of ways, I had to say that to all of these people. If we were going to do this work together, I had to really put my pain in front of them and say, like, this is what's happening. This is what you are doing to me, every one of you in this room. because I don't think there was anybody in the room who hadn't hurt me in some way. And we had to deal with that. And it wasn't easy. It was really difficult. But we're here today and we can talk about this. Like, I can tell Hojin, like, that hurt. And Hojin can hold my pain and not make it about her. Which has been a process for us, right? Like, what it means for me to say, you've hurt me, and then you internalize the hurt, and then I have to take care of you. And it's like, wait a minute, that's not how this is supposed to happen. Right, yeah, exactly. And that happens so much from really nice white people. Hojin's amazing. But it takes some learning and figuring out, you know, what's happening here. And now we can be different, and we can actually have a relationship where my pain isn't erased because she doesn't quite get what's going on, or like she needs care.
Do you think BFOD will help to make that an easier process for residents in the future?
I think so. I mean, I wish I had, you know, the residents at the monastery now, they have meetings together, and I wish we had had something like that, you know, even if it was like a train wreck, but just some kind of recognition that, like, we're having a different experience because we're black, and you don't see it because you're white, and you are just completely blind to everything, even though you've been sitting for God knows how long, and you're, like, really clear, and you see all the things. Like, you are missing something. And so for me, I mean, I think about what BFOD will do for all of us, because the work that we're doing isn't just about, you know, the pain that, you know, that I feel and my seat as a black person, but all of the pain that white people are walking around with. Like, you're all really violent because you've got all this shit in your bodies that you haven't dealt with. And I think Beyond Fear of Difference is about that, all of us trying to work with all of the trauma that exists in our body so that we can actually connect with one another in a way that's real, so that we can move past that pain and see each other, because I think there's a lot of not being seen.
Thank you so much. You've been an amazing, you know, role model for, and we definitely appreciate that and honor your presence. Thank you. Speaking of challenges and cultural shifts, and we had within us in the BFOD group here, we had what we call the incident. Something happened that was very, very troubling for all of us. And I think it was a turning point for this particular group when this incident occurred. Some of us, we could talk about that in terms of how some of us reacted and how this group was on shaky ground after that. And what I want to do is start with you, Karen, if you can tell us a little bit more about the incident.
I'm Karen Jinfu, pronouns are she and her. So this was actually just last July, which is always mind-boggling to me, because something did shift after this particular meeting. It was the first meeting that we didn't have facilitators. It was just us. And what I communicated to the people of color in that group was, in part in words, in part context, was something like this. I feel a deep compassion I feel a deep compassion for animals, but I don't really care about you. So even in the retelling, it's really, I said that. I couldn't hear that. I didn't intend to say that, but the response was like, bam. And what ensued, you know, leading up to it, I could feel that there was something going on in the room. I could feel this problem. And Dyson named it. And so I really was trying to grapple with, what is the problem? I know there's a problem. What's the problem? So this really let off. It was very painful to the people. And pretty much everyone, all of the people of color, gave me feedback in very different ways. And it led to a ripple of many different things coming out. And every time we talk about it, I hear it more deeply, because it's like a dense fog. You know, you say something, I said something like that, and I don't know what is going on. I have no idea what's going on, why I'm getting this horrible response, except that I knew that that's what had, that was the reality. And so I felt really a curiosity, too, to find out what is it that's going on. I lost the second part of it, but maybe I'll come back to it.
Yes. Thank you for sharing that, Jinfu. I really appreciate it. It was a very hard moment, and I would like to have Dyson sort of chime in, because we all had different reactions and different ways of dealing with what had occurred, and I would like Dyson to tell his experience and how this impacted him.
My name is Dyson. He, him. In order to speak about my reaction, I think it's important to know the context of my life. I grew up in the rural South, and I have literally hundreds of racist experiences. I think I've shared maybe 5 or 6 with this group, but it's continuous. And somehow, I mean, for me, what I feel the most is that we have things to offer. So I have a tendency to just look at people kind of openly. Joshin had a lot of pain from that statement. Now, I've been compared to animals a lot by, you know, a lot of people. And Jinfu's pain was obvious. So it was pain. So my experience was, first of all, we're not animals, or all animals, or, you know, there's an equality of being that for me is extremely very clear. And that equality showed itself that day in the pain, which I think was something that, at least for me, it enabled us to come back together. But I think that sums it up for me.
And Joshin, would you like to talk a little bit about your experience?
Yeah. I had such an emotional experience, which is that when I did hear Jinfu's words, it was like a punch to my stomach. Because we're sitting in a circle. I mean, I was already nervous because we were going to be talking about race issues with no facilitator, with white people and people of color. This was going to be bad. And Tanya was like saying, we got to do this. And I'm like, holy shit, we're going to do this. So I went in there already anxious. And then when Jinfu's comment was made, it really was a punch to my stomach. And I couldn't take it. I ended up having to leave the room. And it wasn't like some like polite sobbing thing. It was like an embarrassing, loud torrent of tears and anger, and just like they could hear me apparently inside the room. I was outside the room, and I was just crying. And Zuiko came out to me, and I said, "I'm out. I'm not doing this." I said, "This is harder than I signed up for. I didn't sign up for this, and I'm out. And I'm not going back into that room because it's hostile territory." Those are exactly the words I said. It's hostile territory in there. And she said, "It's okay. You don't have to go back. You don't have to do anything." And I said, "Good, because I'm out." And then we were at the monastery, so I decided to take I had all this energy, and I didn't want to go back into the room, so I decided to walk up and down the mountain. So that's what I did, and I was just storming up and down the mountain. Like the first time up was not enough energy to get it all out, so I would come down. And I was, like, kind of relieved and happy because I was like, "I'm out. I said I was out. I don't have to do this anymore. Who needs this? Don't let those white people work on their stuff. I'm out." And then up the mountain again and down the mountain, and by the third time I was going up, you can sense how much energy there is and going up that mountain fast. By the time I was finished going up and down the mountain, I did feel the need to return. And I really returned for the other people of color in there. I felt I had let them down because I was so busy crying, which was, I couldn't help it. One never knows what the reaction will be. I really had no idea that's how I would react. But I felt ashamed that they needed me to be articulate and that I wasn't, and that I had let them down. And honestly, I felt I had left them alone in hostile territory, and I had to go back in there and be with them. So I went back. But like Tanya and Jinfu and Dyson have said, the stuff that came, we were not happy. We were not happy campers when we left there. We were barely looking at each other. We did this go around of what can you be grateful for? I didn't want to be grateful for anything. The fallout continued through Basecamp, which is our digital format, through texts, through phone calls, through emails. We just kept hashing and hashing and hashing it out and trying to figure out how to handle and the way forward and how did we all react and why did we react differently and what role did Zen and our practice play in how we reacted and how we weren't there for each other because we kind of weren't. And so I think that the big lesson in all of that, why we keep bringing this up to talk about, is that it was a really bad moment, but we did make it through. And we did continue to work together.
Exactly. I mean, it's possible to like totally go through these really bad experiences and we're still here. We're on the stage together. We're still doing this work together. We work through these things. It's not going to be peaches and cream, whipped cream, strawberries. It's going to get ugly sometimes. And that's just the nature of the work, and that we're showing proof that it's possible to come to the other side of that and stick in this and understand it. It's about why this is so important, which is why we're all still here. And, you know, you stuck with it, you know, even though everything that was going on. I know that I made her apologize to me personally. I made Jennifer, I said, no, I don't want an email. I want you to talk to me, you know, and talk about this. And you know, and that we all had our own way of how we needed to come to the other side. And so for me, that was important to have that that personal sort of conversation before I could feel like, okay, we can move on from this. Marie, did you have anything?
Oh, sure. Sorry. Another point that I wanted to make was that the Beyond Fear Differences for me was an opportunity to get a chance to work with white people in Dharma who are open-minded, liberal. And, you know, given my rural background and the people that I've interacted with, I thought maybe there was an opportunity to, you know, create real friendships and do something in the world positive. And that experience, there was also a lot of white silence. You were almost alone in terms of interacting with people of color. And that was very surprising to me. And like Joshin said, you know, I said I was going to leave the group, and I think a couple of other people felt that way also. So, but we did work through it. But I think it shows the depth of institutional cultural racism that it's very difficult for white people to see it.
Yeah, and I wanted to also actually ask, in keeping with that, some of the white folks on the panel, in terms of white silence being one way, but in what other ways do you think that you have perpetuated or that you have not shown up for this work, this BFOD work? And what other ways do you see that coming out in the way you've responded to some of the things that we've done, in the way you've responded to some dialogues or not? Can someone give me just a few brief examples of ways in which that you feel you haven't shown up?
Yeah, and that day was a perfect example how you all of your lives had been through a particular struggle, which we were scattered. We didn't have to think about any of what they were joining on. And so I was just like I couldn't budge. Like I felt something happened. I right when it happened, but I was motionless, speechless, like just I didn't know what to do with myself, and so it just emphasized all the I needed a lot of education and work myself. I needed to really get on my own process, and work with what I was experiencing. And it became urgent in that moment, because these were my friends, and I also felt a lot of love in the room at the same time, in that, you know, we were in, but there was something. You know, it's interesting about, there's things like, you know, one woman I was with, we had an incident. This was way in the beginning, and she looked at me in the face and said, you have that white girl's gaze. And I was just like, what do you mean? You know? And she said, you don't know what that means. I said, I don't. I really don't. So, so an investigation and, lost my train of thought here. What did I want to say? Yeah, so from what we've been doing, there's like the whole neuro pathways. You know, I went to one of these workshops, and they went through the history, and suddenly in there, I was just like the whole schema, just from all we'd been doing, and all these, the whole layout of the history and the systems that were in place. I all of a sudden just started, I mean, coming in like full speed ahead, like downloads just waking me up at night. And once you start to see, just like in Dharma practice, it just starts, you start seeing it everywhere. And that's a good thing, you know? So I feel like now there's things that, it's a natural response, something. And I go back and I'm like, who's she? You know? Cause I didn't see that before. And there's still a lot more, but, that's what's happening in the whole, connection, going into my own segregation first, the parts of my heart that I'm separate from, that I have to do on my cushion, the ways I deny my own history, reclaim my own past, so going backwards, it goes forward, and it always is just now. And so, yeah.
Thank you. Sean, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, I would. I feel like as white people, we really have to realize that our business in this investigation is understanding whiteness, is understanding white supremacy, is understanding the racist views that we have been fed, digested, metabolized, and live in us, whether we're conscious of it or not. And that that is going to be reflected in our actions, and that we have to start paying attention and be really willing to receive feedback and be in relationship with people of color who will give us that feedback. I remember, you know, in that meeting, totally, I mean, as Hojin said, feeling like silenced. You know, there's an experience, I think, of feeling like I'm white, race isn't my problem. And that's such a deluded view. And so, you know, it's like starting there. I think it's so great that Yunin and Donna are doing the What is Whiteness work here at the temple. And I would encourage anyone who hasn't been participating to take that up. And we want to get a group like that going up at the monastery. But just to give an example, you know, in that same meeting, I remember Jordan saying very passionately, you know, we're sitting in a group. It's the folks you see here, plus Gokhan, plus Shugen, plus Zuiko. So, you know, a lot of the monastics and the teachers, the abbot, the people with power in the Sangha. And Jordan was saying, like, you know, all the people with power are in this room. Why isn't change happening? Why are we still getting a program catalog where all of the teachers are white? and we were unable to say anything. I mean, what do you say to that? Like, I'm sorry, I didn't notice? Because that's basically what it came down to. So things like that are happening constantly. Now, point B is a few days later, we have we're on a base camp electronic community messaging thing. So it's a few days after that meeting, very heated meeting, feels like the group could fragment. It's not clear what's going to happen. We're sort of trying to feel each other at a distance. And there's talk about how do we bring in POC voices into the planning and the work of running the monastery, running the temple. So you see, that's a paradigm shift. That's not how the monastery runs. It's a little bit more how the temple runs. Even there, certain key decisions are made by certain key people, and those key people are white. So that whiteness is infusing all of that. It just is. So on the base camp thread, somebody said, what about having people of color in the programming meetings? So when we're deciding who's going to come and be a teacher at the monastery, how about some people of color in that committee? Well, the people who decide programming are, it's a few people historically who are all white sitting down at a table and kind of filling in boxes and checking off lists. So I wrote, after all of this, I was like, oh, you know what? I think it's okay because I really hear you guys. I get it now. I feel like I can be accountable. So this is a really good example of a white person being like, well-meaning, well-intentioned. Got it, Jordan. Message received. I've got this one. I don't actually need you to show up at the table because now I understand. And as you might imagine, there was a lot of anger that came through. We had to basically freeze the base camp thread. Suiko put a post up that was like, okay, we're tabling everything. All decisions are frozen until we can meet in person. And from that following meeting, things are happening. So things are happening, and it's so exciting. We have a programming committee now. Tanya and Joshin are both on the committee. Hojin and me and Shugen are the other three members. And I don't know if you noticed, but the most recent program catalog, if you look at the temple, it's a rainbow of teachers, and we want to carry that forward going forward. Yeah, a couple of them ended up having to cancel, but that was just circumstances. So anyway, yes.
Thank you. And to you, Hogan, and the Dharma is still okay. Okay. Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to finish up with the meeting because I think what started to crack at that meeting for me was that, and it's going to the, this is my problem. It's not the problem of people of color. It's how white people show that they don't really care. And we do it all the time. It's a resistance. It's a, someone doing the prep work last minute. It's a low priority. It's I see this. I'll listen to a program on the news, or I'll be reading something and I'm affected by it, and I close the chapter and I can walk away. And so what I try to do now is sort of linger in this, what that turning away is. It's because I don't do that with other people. I like things affect me. So it's, I feel like that's a space of conditioning and this blindness and this, and we still do it. We're still doing, the white people in this group are still doing it. And we're just getting a little bit quicker. Sometimes we catch it ourselves. We're better at sort of talking and kind of moving through that.
Yeah, you're not going to turn into Martin Luther King overnight. So, and that's okay. That's totally fine. In our few minutes remaining, I want to ask a few things. But one, in terms of, we've been talking a lot about racism, and I think, Sean, you mentioned that in this particular effort of BFI. And this has been one of our dominant issues. But BFI, just so you know, attempts to tackle all sorts of oppressions of, from sexual orientation, sexual identity, class, gender, ableism, etc. One of the cultural shifts that we've had to make is to stop examining these things in silos, because we've even gotten feedback from people say, well, why are we talking about class? why are we not talking about gender, or why are we not talking about this? So one of the things that that BFOD has been doing has been really looking at these things in terms of how these things intersect. That we can't just talk about gender without talking about race, or we need to talk about race when we talk about the environment, or class when we talk about the environment. You can't talk about class without talking about race or gender. You know what I mean? These are things that are, we can't talk about these things in silos. And that's why we number 8 in our values, we talk about the whole person framework in terms of analyzing these things within as they intersect. And so I wanted to ask you all quickly if you could try to sort of chime in. What is the importance of this, cultural shift in terms of examining these things within a whole framework, not just in silos? Because I know we've struggled with that even here. We should just only talk about gender. Let's just do something on gender. I'm like, no, we have to talk about race too. And so how is that working?
So real quick, if we think about Trumpism and equate that to care for the earth, the juxtaposition of unfounded ways of having viewpoints, they go together. And the reliance on truth or reality has a wide-ranging, connected sort of reverberation or proliferation. So I think that it's not curious that people who support Trumpism have difficulty seeing the problems with the earth.
I think the whole person framework is so important and kind of comes down to really the simple things that we do. And I think so much of this comes from being a residency, living at the monastery for a year, living here for 6 months, and thinking about what it means, particularly when you're a residency and in training, that you're giving up some of your autonomy in a way. So you show up to a work meeting and somebody's going to tell you what to do and you don't get to negotiate that. So what does it mean that Gokhan, a white man who has a particular place in the world, gets to tell me what to do, and he gets to decide how he says it to me? And I think in training, there's this presumption that Gokhan knows what he's doing, and I'll listen to him, and I'll trust that. But not when he hurts me, even if he doesn't mean to. And the same thing with Shugen, and any other person, but, this pervasive feeling of, there's somebody who's more senior to you and they know what they're doing. That's not always true. And I think, where we come from in the world, who we are, our identities are so important when we're interacting with each other and when we're practicing, even though our practice is all about this identitylessness, letting go of the self. But all I'm ever doing is bringing myself to the practice. Somebody who I'm working with, they're bringing themselves to the practice. So where does, Gokhan and all of his big manness, how does he relate to me? How do we relate to each other when we're in the dining hall, when we're here having cookies and tea? What parts of ourselves are we bringing to this in terms of interacting with each other, and the parts of ourselves that we might not even realize, what it means to trust ourselves? What parts of ourselves, the parts of ourselves that are really anxious and trying to be something that we think we're supposed to be? And then that coming out as violence again, us hurting each other. And we never mean it. We never intend to hurt each other, I don't think. But we really are. And I think that's why it's so important to not just think about these things in silo. So it's not just a race issue ever. It's always race, gender, class, sexual orientation, gender expression, everything. Where you come from, what language you speak at home, what's your first language, what kind of education you had access to, what work you did, what work your parents did. Those things are so important because they frame how we interact with other people, how we interact with ourselves, and then how everything is happening between us. All of those things are so important. The land that we're on, how did we get this land? Who was on this land? Who died so that we could have this space, this building, so that we could go to and from in Brooklyn, so that we can go up to the monastery? Who had that monastery before we did, and how did it get there? So
preach,
those things are
preach.
So important to how we are and where we are in the world, you know, where the land that we grew up on came from. Those things all are infused into this work that we're doing. And it's so important. We can't section things off and do things one at a time. We have to do it together.
Thank you for that. That was beautiful. Now we want to talk about the future in our last few minutes here. We want to look at where this is going. Obviously, I'm sure that's on a lot of your minds. When we did this forum at Zen Mountain Monastery, Shugen Roshi was very clear that this is not a phase, that this is what we're doing right now. Like, this is happening, and it's going to be a continual process. So with that in mind, I wanted to talk a little bit about, ask you about why Fire Lotus Temple, this particular temple being in the middle of an urban area in Brooklyn, why it's positioned to make inroads in terms of increasing diversity. Then perhaps maybe what assets do we have here that could make this a very viable place to really do this work and do it effectively?
I really think I'm the last person to answer this question. I think you should answer that question. I think the Sangha should step forward, and both there's a responsibility and a power. And, you know, the tendency in a hierarchical system is to centralize the power in the hands of the few, and you, the Sangha, bow to that power. And that's just the way the system is. And if you want to practice, that's how it is. Now, there is something to hierarchy. There is something to power. But one person's power does not denature anyone else's power. And so I look at this, and I'd like to hear what Hojin says, as an opportunity for selected individuals coming together as a group. And, you know, the one lesson I've learned in coming to the MRO, even though it may not have, maybe it was late in applying it to these areas, is that we are so much more powerful in groups, in mini sanghas and maxi sanghas, than any one person individually. Because we're all limited in our conditioning and our perspective and our power relationship and on, you know, our neurosis. But together, something remarkable happens. And so it's not just Buddha Dharma. It's Buddha Dharma you, and I'm not excluding myself, but sometimes the people in power need to just listen. And by the way, I want to acknowledge Zuiko for her warriorship, if you will, in making that clear to me numerous times, which wasn't always welcomed, and yet her persistence in bringing that forth. So a lot of this is about power in every silo. And so I'm thinking a lot about that. And I know all the other teachers are thinking a lot about that.
Thank you. Does anyone else have anything to add to that? Or are we all good? Well, I wanted to say, and as we end this panel discussion today, before we take final thoughts, I just wanted to say, even with our creation of the timeline that you see, that's evidence of this evolution, because initially it was just, oh, let's just do a timeline, you know, let's just do the history and we'll just outline it. And it was like immediately the people of color were like, wait, can we read that first before you put the, you know, because if you all know, if you ever see going to events and you've done timelines or seen them, you know how many things are left out. The voices that are left out of that history. And so that timeline reflects like the courage of Zuiko, who's initially did what you saw, that little line across, that straight line across the history. And then we sort of stepped in and said, this is missing. This is missing. This narrative is not there. That this is like a living thing, and how even the telling of history is very charged and is power in who gets to tell that history. And by us having all these voices come together to be a part of telling that history, we get a more complete picture. Now that, you know, it's more true. It's more authentic. And so this was a great exercise for us, and it was wonderful working on that and seeing people come in and give their voice and correct things and add things, you know. So that's really part of what this work is. And I wanted to just ask before we end the panel, if anyone had any final thoughts, anything that you haven't felt like you wanted to say, haven't had a chance to say before we wrap it up.
I feel like my emotion has a lot to do with the fact that this is a really brutal reality that we don't want to look at. So,
anyone else? Okay. Yes.
I got this thing. I feel like this is just an auspicious moment for us as a Sangha, and that you say in Spanish, pa'lante, which just means forward. We're going to go forward, and we can do this. We can do this. You have my heart. You have my spiritual life. There's nothing else.
Thank you. So thank you for listening to us. We have two more important processes to go, so please stay with us if you can. What we want you to do now is we're going to take about 10 minutes or so for you to write your questions down and to sign in. If you haven't signed in, please make sure you do that during this break, because we want to follow up. We want to tell you what you asked. We want to answer questions. Yes.
So, okay. Yeah, the questions, the white cards are good for the questions. It could be on either, but the post-it notes will be used for another process on the wall.
So use the white cards for them. Yeah.
Yeah, you just deposit your questions into the bin. They could be anonymous. Thank you for giving it some thought.
And thank you. And when you're done, you can just bring them up and we'll put them in these containers there, and then we'll choose a few. And then what we're going to do, we're going to reconvene. And once we collect all the questions, and then we're going to come back and we're going to answer a few of those questions together. And then we'll move on to our next exercise. Your questions. And as I said before, if you gave us a question, it's not going to go unanswered, so don't worry about that. Oh, yes, the podcast.
Well, there's been conversation. Actually, Zuiko had the idea that it would be really cool to take some of the questions, particularly those that seem to recur in different forms. If we can't or don't get to them today, because we'll just take a few now, that we have are considering doing like conversations about some of these things as podcasts and putting them out there.
Okay. All right. So we couldn't possibly get to all the questions. Thank you all for your questions. They're amazing. And we kind of just picked a couple that kind of stood out to us. And this particular question really like got me going. So the question, I'm going to read it verbatim for the most part. But it says, are there any people of Asian descent in BFOD? A former resident who was of Asian descent expressed discomfort, and they expressed that to somebody in the order, and they were not listened to. One of the huge elephants in the room that I often think about is, you know, how is our practicing this cultural appropriation? And I don't have the answers. I'm probably going to mess up and say something off-putting. But I mean, I often wonder, you know, what is our role in taking this Japanese culture that came from China, that came from India, and calling it our own? Like, I think about my robe and how much that means to me. But why? And I think that is so much a part when we're thinking about who we are and how we move in the world as practitioners and how we can be skillful, what it means for us to really appreciate where everything that we do comes from, the liturgy, the form. Like, I don't know where half of it comes from. And it feels so important for us to be more curious about it, because it can become a performance if we're doing these bows, we're saying these words, and we have no idea where they come from or what they mean or the significance of them. And we also feel so convicted and strongly about doing it right. But like, we didn't make up, we didn't come up with any of this. Like, none of this is our own. And, you know, Zuiko and I have talked about this a lot. And she sends her love. She's going through a lot and she couldn't be here today. But we've talked about this a lot. And, you know, she's often said that it kind of feels like the last frontier. Like, we kind of can't go there yet because that is so much of our identity as Zen practitioners. But I hear this question loud and clear. And I want to know, like, I feel like I don't have answers. And I feel like I wonder what, you know, folks with Asian descent feel when they come here and we train them in this, this ancient practice that is closer, more theirs than mine. And I feel like that's something that I want us to think about more often and maybe have formal conversations. I mean, the monks, I feel like, know more about the tradition and the roots of things, but I don't know about them. And I really want to, because I don't want this to be a performance, me taking somebody's culture and their life and their history, and just putting on a show. I want it to be deeper than that. I feel the depth of it, but I don't know. I don't have words, or I can't put it to something. So I'm thinking about that, and I hope that I can hear from more folks in the Sangha who have Asian descent, who are from Asian, who have Asian heritage, and feel like we're not doing this right. Because I imagine we're not doing it the best way we could.
I hope that one thing that people take away from today is really an invitation to participate. So one thing that I also hear in that question, you know, are there people of Asian descent in the planning group? No, right now there aren't, but it would be great. Yeah, okay, sorry, I was thinking, yeah, Gikhan's Indian. So if if you're hearing what's happening and you're interested and you want to be involved, then, like, we want you to be involved. So that's what I wanted to say.
And that's about everything too. Like, I mean, there was a question about sexual orientation in there, exactly. About, you know, exactly. How you feel in the Sangha as a gay person, how you feel in the Sangha as a person who might identify as whatever, whoever you are. Like, this is very much an invitation to say, we are missing somebody. We are marginalizing somebody. We don't want to do that. Help us. Come and tell us. Whether that's you being angry, pissed off, disappointed, like, give it to us, because we can't see it all. And it's not going to be easy. We might not listen to you the first time, and shame on us for that. But, like, I feel like we really need to hear from everybody, because, yeah, we can't do it any other way.
Yeah. Before we move on to the next question, I want to also mention, that's why I encourage people to go to 7A's retreat called What Gets Left Out, because exploring cultural spiritual bypassing, because that's also a lot of things that we leave out of the ancestral, and really connecting to, you know, where this practice comes from and the people that you know, where we got this, you know, we're getting this practice from, and all the other ways that we don't show up as full people to the practice, and bringing these things in to the practice. And how do we do that? How is that going to happen as a Sangha? How are we going to change things, or, you know, to make space for those things that generally get left out?
And thinking about ableism and ageism, like, the Sangha's always getting older. How do we take care of our older Sangha members who can't walk up the stairs? How can we take of our young Sangha members who, for whatever reason, their bodies don't work in a particular way, that can't maneuver around here? I mean, we had a guest teacher come here, and she asked me, you know, how does a person get into the temple who is in a wheelchair? And, like, my entire, like, body just fell out of existence, because all I could say is, they can't be here. And that just pained me to know that, like, we aren't accessible to people. Like, people can't access the Dharma here if they can't get through the door or up two flights of stairs. So thinking about how we can do that, because I really don't know. I don't have answers. I mean, I take for granted my ability to just jump around and do all of the things without thinking about them. And I want to know how we can do this better.
Next question.
We just got these questions, so it's not like we had a time to like really process them. And so if someone else on the panel wants to also give it to add on. So do you see others being excluded by liberal groups such as the Beyond Fear of Differences? And by others, I mean conservatives. This is what it says. So my own feeling was that I didn't see this as a liberal versus conservative endeavor. I didn't see this as a political belonging to one box or the other. I see this as Dharma work, and that whenever we do the uncomfortable work of investigating ourselves, as Dogen asks us to do, that's just Dharma work, and that's not politics. So I don't think that I'm reflecting necessarily what everyone else feels about this question, and that some people are reading into it, perhaps, that conservatives may be more comfortable living in segregated or in silos or not looking at things, because I don't understand how else this question could be asked. Like, to me, Dharma work is not political work, and this is Dharma work, so it's not liberal or conservative. No conservative could be excluded from it, just like you're not excluded from the Zendo, and you're not excluded from the mandate to investigate yourself or to be uncomfortable. So I see this as non-political. I don't know where it will go. It might go political for somebody, but I see it just as not excluding anyone, and that we have to take a look at ourselves and to collapse barriers wherever we see them, and that's Dharma work. Yeah, so I figured you guys would want to add something on to that.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe I started that by speaking about Trumpism. I apologize for that. So I think the comment that I have is it would not exclude conservatism. The point, though, is to share what is unknown. The amount of racism that an individual like me experiences, that a conservative person does not experience, doesn't have to be separated from conservatism. I mean, a conservative can participate in the group. However, it would be good for people of conservative backgrounds to know, for example, that a seventh grade black boy who is maybe the second highest math score has to advocate to not be put in general high school. That a UVA Master of Computer Science professor will... when I ask, why did I get a B when you can compare these answers with my study mate and he has an A, and the response is, I gave you a B, why don't you leave me alone? Walk down the street, and next thing you know, I got 8 police pointing guns at me multiple times. And to not, I mean, so many times, people say racism does not exist. And, you know, I have kids, and I remember being a kid and coming across these messages. And, you know, I was able to, I think I'm deeply hurt by them, but I can't see that anymore. But the experiences are vast. So conservatives, join us, but recognize that there is a difference in the lives that are experienced by people of color and white people, and that many young people hurt. I mean, they don't have the sort of systems. My parents did not allow me to interact with white people, so I was in college, Cornell, before I really had. And believe me, not interacting with white people and going to Cornell University, that was a shock. But if
if my parents had not segmented me off, I think I would have been in a much worse position. So I'll come across people and you know, they have predispositions about about the capacities of human beings. It's just false. So I remember, I grew up in the South, asking, why is Robert E. Lee, what is that guy famous for? And then I learned. And then I have to, okay, I'm still okay. I'm okay. Over and 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 over, over, over again. So at Cornell University, first 2 years, dean's list. The fall semester of my sophomore year, walking down the street and surrounded by cops and guns pointed at me, just a wild scenario. And out of that, I had anger, but my GPA went from 3.7 to like 0 point whatever, whatever. And that's normal, right? So I'm in corporate America, and so many people, racism doesn't exist. It really doesn't exist. It's just ludicrous. It's just absolutely, absolutely ludicrous. So conservatives, let's all communicate, but there is a reality that we should care about. You know, dharma, love, you know, love is a good thing.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, I was just going to add one thing to that, and I was just going to say what we're talking about here at BFOD is about just recognizing everyone's humanity. Like, when is conservatism against that? Like, I didn't know that that was what conservatism was. Is that, am I missing something? I just didn't realize, but that's what we're talking about. So if that's what you're talking about, then you're welcome here. And this is what this is. And this is, join us. If that's what you're talking about, recognizing people's humanity and treating people with that, with reverence and respect, you know, for who they are and how they show up. So for me, it's beyond, you know, so in that sense, it's not even a question. It's like, where are you where you feel like that's not what you're here to do or shouldn't be doing? Because that we need to talk about, you know, if that's where we're coming from. If that's what we're saying is like, well, I'm not really down for recognizing your humanity, then that's a totally different conversation. I would say, see Hojin, see Shu, make an appointment, and perhaps can work through some of that.
Do you have any questions? So this is a question that I'm gonna pose to the white people. It says, I'm pretty worried about being a race blind white person. What can I do?
Nothing. You have to just be okay with that. Okay. So that's, I'm so sorry. That is the setup. And I'm being glib when I say nothing. I mean, in a sense, like, you shouldn't hold yourself back waiting for, that to change. It's part of the fucked upness of this whole situation. That's why it's so important to be able to look at whiteness and what is whiteness and how have we not seen it and how are we blind to it. And even though we're living in a culture that's completely structured around it. So to begin to do your own work, we have some really great resources on the BFOD webpage. There are some excellent books. There's the book that the What Is Whiteness group is using or was using called What Is Whiteness? What Does It Mean to Be White by Robin DiAngelo. Yes. Robin DiAngelo has another excellent book, a slimmer volume called White Fragility, which is excellent. We used in the resident meetings up at the monastery a podcast called Seeing White, produced out of Duke University and their documentary studies program. And it is excellent. And so that is a 14-part series. The episodes range anywhere from, you know, 15 minutes to an hour and a half. It's a real education. So those are three really great starting places.
Yeah, I just wanted to point at something out of my own experience, which is I would really like to take my prejudice and my power and make black people responsible for it so I don't have to do the work. So I think you understand what I'm saying, but how subtle that is. You know, I'm stating it in an overt way, but this is incredibly subtle. And with the best intent, it slides right off us and we transfer that.
Yeah, and I feel like there's something that's happening in the process where it's not exactly passing the torch, but I feel like people of color have experienced the pain and violence. And so it's okay if we are uncomfortable. So go for it, because that's the only way you're going to get into this, because it's horrible.
There is a retreat coming up also. There is a retreat at the monastery, the Undefended Heart, from June 21st to 23rd, which is practicing white fragility, a retreat for white people that came specifically out of this work, right? Out of this understanding that white folks needed to do work in a space that was safe for them, and to look at this stuff. So I think you should look at that. I mean, I think Zwicka was very instrumental in putting that together, and she's a very thoughtful, as we all know, very thoughtful practitioner. So I think that could be very powerful.
And I think your first three lines, I'm pretty worried. I don't think you have to go much further. But, you know, if you're pretty worried, that's really good. You should be pretty worried. And so you got that part seeping in. So go further. What are you worried about? If you're worried about being a race-blind white person, what can you do? So you already got the worry. So use the worry. Okay, it's already in you. You said it. So that's, yeah, I'll stop there. Yeah. Use the tremble. Talk about that. You're trembling? Use your tremble. Let it guide you. Keep trembling. Deeper and deeper. Let it break your heart over and over and over and over again. We have to break. We've been holding up too long. Sorry. Do you hear me?
You're so good. So we're good on questions then? Okay. So for the sake of time, that's where we're going to end the question part. But again, like we said, we're going to answer your questions. We're going to use some creative ways to do that and bring you in for some of you who had these questions. So don't despair. Now, the next part, the last exercise we're going to do today before we come back together, I'm going to ask you to take the stickies, the yellow Post-its, and on outside in the hall, you've probably seen there's some prompts, and it says, you know, I'm afraid, or I'm angry, I need, and I hope. What we want you to do is tell us. Right. And you can do for any of them as you want, as many as you want. You can, if you think of more than one thing, you can write that in one column. It doesn't matter. What are you afraid of? I mean, if you heard all of this, you've taken this in, you know what we're doing, you know, you've read the timeline. What makes you afraid? Tell us that. What is it that you makes you angry? Is it something that you're just like, look, this is pissing me off, you know? Write that. We want to know how you really feel. And what do you need to do this work? If you say, hey, I'm thinking about this, or I feel like I might be interested, or even that you feel like you can't do it right now, but what would you need to do this? What's missing that you feel you would need? And then lastly, what makes you hopeful about this process? So we're going to give you, like, same as before, like 10 minutes or so, and just take the Post-its and just fire away.
And I just wanted to add, thank you, Tanya.
It's
and, you know, sometimes we call it exercises, and then there's practice. And practice gives longevity. This isn't going to the gym and doing an exercise. We're going to hit this practice again. It's a practice. So to get this onto this post-it is a practice. You're now practicing your voice. You're practicing identifying fear. You're practicing identifying what makes you angry. It's anonymous. So practice it. Dig in. This is how it's going to happen. Like, don't do it at the common fears on the top. But what? Like, really get it out. What are you afraid of? Okay? So that's the practice. It's that raw honesty. So if you got to go sit in the corner and sit for a moment to get the question, then do it. Do it. Because this is how the work's going to happen when we sit together. We're going to have to practice together.
Wow. Thank you, Ocean. That was amazing. Thank you. So let's go. Let's do it. Let's do this right now. We'll let you know when it's time. Thank you. Join us again. Thank you. Thank you so much for this overwhelming response to the prompts. That's going to be really helpful. We're going to transcribe all of that, and you'll be able to, right? We'll be able to see what people said. And you know, for us, we were reading what people wrote at Zen Mountain, and it was just really like, wow. So thank you for your honesty and responding to those prompts. So what we're going to do now is we're going to talk about the future. I know a lot of people are wondering, like, how can I get involved or what's next? So that's what we're talking about now. We're going to let you know what some of the opportunities are, the ways that you can get involved. We're going to be sending a survey. That's why it was important for you to sign in, so we know it was here. So we're going to send you a survey so you can tell us a little bit more about yourself and what areas you may be interested in, if you're interested in joining a committee to work on some of the education issues programs, and retreats you may be interested in, some of the affinity groups work that's going on. So that's going to be real important. So when you get that, which we'll send out very quickly, just respond to that so we can work on that, getting you involved. So we're going to start with Jordan, who's going to talk a little bit about the Affinity Mentorship Program, which is new and exciting. So tell us all about it, Jordan.
We want to launch this Affinity Mentorship Program for people of color and for people a part of the LGBTQ community, as if I'm not, you know, so weird. Who are we? and I think oftentimes the big question is why? Why affinity mentors, and why for this group of people in particular? You know, I've heard Zuiko say this over and over again. She says, like, when you call the monastery, if you are a white person, you can be sure that somebody on the other side of the phone is probably also white, and probably also straight, and probably also cis. And the importance of having these affinity groups is, you know, particularly when people are coming to the monastery or here, you want to know if you can be there and you can be safe. And you can't always ask those questions to somebody who you don't particularly share an identity with. That conversation just can't really happen. And white people, there's somebody for you at the monastery. So we reach out to the Sangha and say, if you are a person of color or you're part of the LGBTQ community, we want you to also be a voice for people who want to come in, who want to have those conversations with you. I feel like amongst ourselves, those conversations are less difficult, but, you know, it's always hard to say, you know, can I be here? Is it safe for me to be in a particular place? That's something I thought about when I was, you know, considering residency. So yeah, maybe have more questions, and we're always here.
Just sort of point of clarification. So it would be, is the idea that it would be people of color within the Sangha mentoring people, like newcomers of color to the Sangha, for example? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yes, and not even newcomers. If you've been here for a while and you're just like, let's talk, maybe we haven't, or like you've been in and out, wherever you are as far as how long you've been a part of the Sangha, you can request a mentor or ask to be a mentor. And this has come out of this happening informally. You know, Joshin has given people my number and my email, and we've connected and talked about my experience in residency. We were kind of like, oh, this should happen more often and maybe in a more formal way so that people know that they can do this. So yes, that's it.
Great. That will be on the survey. So make sure if you are interested, if you feel like you need a mentor, you would like to become one, to actually respond to that part. Would you like to take the committee work?
Sure. So one of the things that came out of our work as a planning group is this recognition that we need a diversity of voices in all of these different areas that are helping to create the Sangha that we all practice in. And right now we have three committees, an education committee, programming committee, and communications committee. The communications committee are the ones that planned and structured and brought you this forum, just to give you an example, and that took a lot of work. And the programming committee I mentioned earlier, that's programming here and at the monastery. The education committee, I can't see what it says in light green. Oh, helping us to plan residence meetings, helping, there's a lot of work needs to be done to educate our Sangha, to educate each other, educate ourselves, and bring this work forward into the community. So that would be something that the education committee will be stepping up on. And there could be more committees beyond this. This is how we have started, and many of us are members of one or more of those committees. So it's a way to bring your voices in and participate. It's a commitment. And if you check off that box on your survey, we'll give you more information, and you can see if it's something that you actually would want to be able to want to and be able to make a commitment to.
A quick comment. So, so Joshin, Marie, Suise, we had a lot of momentum in November and December. We have to pick it back up. But one of the aspects of the education committee is to build an umbrella, if we could, within the community for people of color, youth, to have some tools to be able to withstand systemic racism, and to let that be a vehicle that comes through the Dharma. So have an opportunity to educate people, you know, with Dharma, and have it be done in a way that gives some positive reinforcement to self-images. I think the initial feedback with the mission statement and the values and the vision that I had was that it was very difficult to implement, too broad, too wide. But we're taking a stab at it. We are trying to see what we can do.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Now, we wanted to also mention some of the upcoming programs and retreats that we have. Hojin, do you want to say anything about that, or do you want me to just go over it? Okay. So basically, as we mentioned here, on April 20th, we're going to have Sebane Selassie coming for a retreat called What Gets Left Out, Exploring Cultural Spiritual Bypassing. And it's really good in terms of, I actually took this retreat with her at another place. It was a longer, more extended one. But we looked at everything that gets left out, from the feminine to nature, and the ways that we leave this out of our practice, and how, ways that we can bring this back in. We do ancestral work, connecting with our ancestors, which we don't really do here, you know, at all. So, those type of things it's going to explore, and it's really an interesting topic. If we're, you know, especially centering around this BFA work, because a lot of us feel like we have to leave things out when we come in the door, some part of ourselves. So this is a way to say, how can we reclaim that? How can we coming in the door and still bring these things and have it enrich our song instead of feeling like it's destroying it in some way. And then the Undefended Heart, Practicing White Fragility, June 21st to 23rd. On our survey, you'll see a list of other retreats that are coming up. And if you're interested in attending and just thinking about it, you know, you'll check that and then we'll get back to you with more information. And then we also have affinity groups, as we talked about earlier. We have the people of color, affinity group that we're trying to get back up and starting again. If you're interested in that, let us know. The LGBTQ group, and also the white affinity group. So there are opportunities to get support throughout this process while you're doing this work. So if we just strongly encourage there are way, you know, if you're interested in getting involved, please take that survey because that's the only way we will really know and can contact you and get you started in this work. And yes, thank you.
And I just wanted to invite the artists to come forth for creative ways that we can blow this open. You know, James Baldwin speaks a lot about the artists being sort of the shamans in the culture and the heartbeat, and this is the hub right here. So we need your creativity. We need to hear from painters, dancers, movers, and shakers of other ways to get into our consciousness. Music is so powerful. Written words, so we know. So that's part of programming. We're trying to bring in those variety of people that have that spirit. So if you know, bring that in. And I also want to encourage the women to get together. We're doing a women's Zazenkai, one of the best natural untapped resources on this planet, is women. And I think we need to get, and men, you have your gigs too. You can put that, but, there's work, there's, we give birth to Buddhas, so there's a lot that we need to sit down together to do because we've been separated from each other for even just as long. So that's all.
Anyone have anything else to add before we end our day?
If somebody could speak just briefly about what the resources are on the web, particularly, I bet there's people here sitting wondering what's there, and I would think there's lots of educational resources that people could go home right now and pick something up to educate themselves.
I think you just said it, Ishan. There's lots of educational, I've named a few things that I thought were helpful for me in my study of whiteness. It can be a little overwhelming. There's so much material there. We keep finding things and just adding it. So that might be a future project, is to like organize or annotate it a bit. But if you look at it and you don't know how to get started, we have an email for the planning group, bfod@dharma.net? MRO.org? MRO.org. We also have a web page.
Where on the web, like where can you find these resources?
Okay, so if you go to our little, you know, you go to the hamburger and it gives you the drop down, there's a thing that says programs, and when you go to programs, it goes vrrr, and in that there is Beyond Fear of Differences. Teresa?
On Facebook, there's a link to the right on the Fire Lotus Facebook. There's a link to the resources. Thank you, Teresa.
And of course, along with this climate, we'll be also taking care of our Earth, and those programs are on there too, which Ishan's part of.
I think we had a few copies of this. There was a little brochure that I believe someone who used to be. Developing trans competence. It's on the table over there where you signed in. And that's really interesting because a lot of times we don't think about, you know, room assignments and, you know, those type of things that no one will really think about, but they're really, really important. So these are just some of the resources, and I think that's also posted there. So it's just one of the resources and ways in which that we can educate ourselves so everyone feels welcome in this space. Anything else? Okay, well, we want to thank you for coming. If you have time and you want to still look at the prompts, feel free. You can look at the timeline if you haven't didn't get a chance to get through all of that. Thank you so much for coming, and you've been wonderful. Thank you. Thank you to the panel. Thank you, panelists. Thank you. And we look forward to having you be a part of this work. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.